Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
During this time, it's more important than ever to support our friends and neighbors in the restaurant industry. Restaurant Workers Community Foundation has set up a national COVID-19 crisis relief fund. The money they raise will provide direct relief to individual restaurant workers, support other nonprofits serving restaurant workers in crisis, and offer zero-interest loans for restaurants to get back up and running. Visit restaurantworkerscf.org to donate today. And if you need a little extra motivation, you can DM your $20 donation to RWCF's co-founder, John DeBerry, on Twitter, and he'll give you directions for making a signature quarantine cocktail. Donate now at restaurantworkerscf.org.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Arroway, reporting to you live from my closet in Brooklyn, not at our headquarters at Roberta's Pizza, unfortunately. But, you know, if you can just take a moment to flash back to about 2 months ago, so before the coronavirus shut down restaurants to dine-in customers and, you know, shut down much of social life in the U.S., let's just try to remember that the narrative that we've been hearing so much about in the past few years when it comes to restaurant culture is how immigrant cuisines, and I'm going to say particularly Asian immigrant cuisines, were being, beautifully and lovingly interpreted by this bold, smart, innovative generation of chefs in America. So, you know, I'm talking about folks who were subverting tradition in favor of this highly personal sense of authenticity to them and just connecting with diners and home cooks who also saw no boundaries to their tastes, to their cooking, to flavors. And also, one of the prevailing narratives that we'd been seeing a lot of was that finally, more Asian cuisines were being recognized as serious fine dining institutions, winning awards, winning Michelin stars, etc. So I got to say that Korean American chefs and restaurants have played a huge role in this. So, Asian dining renaissance that I'm talking about. So, you know, everyone from household names like Roy Choi and David Chang to fearless chefs like Edward Lee, Dookie Hong, Dennis Lee of Namugaji, Corey Lee of Bennu, Rachel Yang of Julae, Soohee Kim of Insa and The Good Fork. And, you know, Korean cuisine doesn't exactly have as long of a history in the U.S. as maybe others do, like Chinese, for instance, but it seems to have really grown up quite fast. So, speaking of brilliant creative minds and chefs of Korean cooking, I'm so honored to have a chef who actually received the first ever Michelin star for a Korean restaurant in New York City. That was his restaurant, Danji, in Midtown Manhattan. He also has a sister restaurant, Hanjan, and he has a first cookbook out. I'm so excited about it. It's called My Korea, Traditional Flavors, Modern Recipes. So thanks so much for coming on the show, Hoonee Kim.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Kathy.
Yeah, I'm sorry that we're just on the phone, but, you know, we're trying to do what we can do. And, you know, this book was like a long-awaited book of yours since you've been such a well-known chef. And I'm sorry that it came out at this time when you can't do, you know, in-person interviews and tours. But first and foremost, like, how are you doing and how is your restaurant doing right now, given this crisis?
Oh, wow. It's sort of depressing. Danji is closed for as of now. It's in the theater district. So we closed as soon as the theater closed. And we decided to do takeout delivery. But because I have two restaurants and Hanjan, my second restaurant, is a little bigger, we decided to just pull all our resources there. So I have staff from Danji and as well as Hanjan. Now working at Hanjan to feed 160 families each week. And we don't do like the call-in internet app deliveries.
Right.
Because, you know, 30% for us is a big deal. And we just figured out doing the math that we're not going to make any money. When we have to give 30% of all our revenue to these apps. So what we decided to do was make a meal kit for maybe a family of four would be 2-3 dinners. Or if somebody is a couple living at home, it might be 5 meals. So we deliver ourselves to families living in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan 5 days a week. About 30 to 35 deliveries a day. And we've been sold out.
Yeah. You sell out. And by saying yourselves, like your chefs, your staff, they're going and delivering?
Up until last week, it was me and my manager. My manager would be the one driving in my SUV. And I'd be the one going up to the buildings and dropping the food off in front of their apartment doors and then texting them, telling them, yay. The food's outside. And it was sort of the only way we figured out that we could survive and be able to pay or hire some of the staff back. The first week we did it, the first day we sold 10, and that first week we sold 80. And when we first started, it was basically me, my manager at Danji, my manager at Hanjan, and my chef at Hanjan. So it was four of us. Two were cooking and two were delivering. And that was the first day. And as of now, we were able to hire back 12 people so far. That's awesome. Week by week, we're hiring more. And our goal is to hire as many people as we can because ultimately these people depend on feeding their families through my restaurant. And that was my biggest concern. And it still is.
Chef, that's really fascinating. So the more we order of these meal kits and family meals, I guess, the more staff you can hire back. Is that right?
Yes. And it's not just my restaurant. It's every restaurant. The more you can order from them, the more work they have to do. And the more work we have, the more staff that we need.
Right. Do you think that... First of all, I'm so about to order one. That sounds amazing. But do you think that this pandemic, I mean, will lead to some sort of creative adaptations? I don't know, meal kits, these dinner ideas, maybe some dishes that just work better for this format that you might keep around. I don't know.
Well, for me, it was because it wasn't a one meal delivery. It was meant to be several deliveries. I had to choose dishes that kept well in the fridge or kept well in a freezer. And those dishes tended to be sort of the homey meals, the traditional stews, the marinated meats that we could keep in the freezer. So, you know, very traditional food and they tended to be more popular with the families that ordered. So that's sort of what we're doing. It may not be the most creative. It's definitely not composed. I know that fine dining is having a hard time adapting. But, you know, I think the traditional Asian foods where texture isn't too much contrast. There isn't crispy. There isn't, you know, all these different colors. It's you know, the one pot meals tend to keep well in the fridge.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that are popular.
Cool. So it's like you can like kind of reach into your bag of tricks and be like, you know what, let's focus on this for a while because it fits the moment.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And what else worked was, you know, we gave very detailed instructions on how to warm it up. Because some of the braised dishes, texture is important. And if you warm it up too quick or microwave it, you still get the flavors, but the textures will change dramatically. Mm-hmm. It'll get stiff. The meats will get hard. So we gave very specific directions, and our customers loved that because it wasn't really cooking to me, but to them it was, because they had to follow these directions. And the food was better than just microwaving if they warmed it up or took their time to warm it up, per what the directions said. And me having just finished written this cookbook, I was able to write in easy directions.
That's great. Yeah,
it was fun.
Oh my goodness. You're going to give Blue Apron a run for their money. It's amazing. And, you know, so speaking of your cookbook, this is really, really one of the most beautiful and thorough, I think, cookbooks I've seen in a long time. It's, you know, first of all, the striking cover. Now, it's simple, it's beautiful, it's natural. It is a piece of Napa cabbage or a half of a Napa cabbage head.
Yes.
Why did you decide on that for the cover?
I had to fight for this. And
yeah.
I am so glad my editor, Melanie, sided with me, because most of the marketing, most of everybody else was like, this isn't very appetizing. But, you know, for me, there have been so many cookbooks out, Mangchi's cookbook, and some of the chefs that you've mentioned.
Yeah.
Many of those people, chefs, have already published cookbooks. And, you know, Korean food, like you said, hasn't been around the U.S. as long as Chinese, but there are so many Korean restaurants now. And there is, you know, people like Korean food. People know Korean food is delicious. So it wasn't my big sort of purpose to convince people Korean food is delicious.
Mm-hmm.
People know Korean food is delicious. I didn't have to show like a hot piping spicy stew in the front cover that was so appetizing. And that would be the big draw to the book. Many writers and chefs have already done that for me.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to do was sort of explain that there's a lot of technique when it comes to Korean cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Korean food is not easy to cook.
Mm-hmm.
We can try to make it much easier than it actually is, like Mangchi's doing it. But if you want to do something really well and properly, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of very different than restaurant cooking or European cooking, where it's measured out and sort of you need specific temperatures for exact specific times. That's not what makes Korean food difficult. But what really makes it difficult is you're dealing with live ingredients that do not have the same salinity like a table salt does.
Mm-hmm.
Every soy sauce, every brand, the salinity is different. So, you know, there are instructions in there that'll tell you a cup or a tablespoon of soy sauce, but that all depends on what kind of soy sauce.
Yeah.
And in that way, you know, you have to feel your way through the recipe. And making kimchi, man, it's at least a 2-week process before you can even taste something that's good and acceptable as kimchi. So, you know, it's not easy.
Yeah.
And I wanted to let people know that so many books, because we're Koreans, and because we know Korean cooking is hard, difficult, and exotic, I think a lot of the books in the beginning, and still so, we simplified a lot of the Korean recipes.
Mm-hmm.
But with my book, I wanted to sort of share the whole story, not the simplified version, but the traditional version, the real Korean version. And I've been doing that with my restaurants for so long, I felt like it was time that, you know, we put it in writing.
Wow.
Yeah, thanks, Chef. And I love how you don't shy away from traditional recipes and ingredients, like for instance, in the first section, of appetizers, you have a recipe for a homemade tofu. Mm. So homemade tofu with perilla sauce, and you say you can buy tofu, but a lot of folks make it, and it's just different. And then, of course, you have a recipe for raw blue crabs too, which is
yes, and I would not have put those recipes in the book if it wasn't so popular at my restaurants.
And
it was surprising how popular, especially the raw blue crabs, were. It, definitely seasonal. But we have it every spring, summer at Hanjan, and they were sold out every week, and we had to have people reserve it. Experiences like that sort of allowed me to bring out a lot of these exotic, very Korean traditional foods that you would not see in a typical Korean restaurant in New York or LA. But, the U.S., especially New York, I think a lot of the diners now want the real deal.
Yeah.
They don't want the watered down version of ethnic food. This isn't 20, 30 years ago where ethnic food had to adapt. No, they want the real thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And it seems like you are uniquely positioned to deliver that, as you write in this book that you grew up going to an island that your father was from called So-an-do,
yes,
which you said was like going back in time. People grew chilies and dried it to make gochugaru, the chili flakes, and had chickens. And you said it was a far cry from the food in New York City Koreatown when you moved there at age 9.
Much different from Seoul at that time either.
Yeah.
I mean, this was an island that was sort of lost in time. and it was before sort of electronic Wi-Fi. So, and it was too far away from the mainland to have real wires connecting. So, you know, even electricity was limited in that the homes would have electricity from, I would say, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. That was it. One phone on the entire island.
Oh my goodness. So was this a sort of like a pastoral bliss for you, or?
It was hell. And my mom explained it to me every year while we were going, that this, where we're going, is the furthest place on earth. And it was, because from London or from New York, it was a three-day journey to actually get to my grandmother's home.
Oh my goodness.
We would take the plane. And that time, because of the Soviet Union, we couldn't sort of go directly. We had to go around the Soviet airspace.
What?
So there was no direct flights. We had to stop at Anchorage, which was about an 8-hour flight. And from Anchorage, we would refuel and then go to Korea, which was another 10 hours. So it was about an 18-hour flight. We would land in Seoul, take another flight to a southern city called Gwangju. It was about a 45-minute flight. And then from there, we would have to take a cab to Wando, which was an island that was connected to a bridge at least. And from there, we had to catch a ferry towards So-an-do. But because that island was so small, it didn't have a dock for a ferry. So a little fishing boat, would have to come out 30 minutes into the middle of the ocean, and we would transfer from a ferry to a fishing boat in the middle of the ocean. And
what?
I didn't know how to swim, and I still don't know how to swim because it was so scary. It was so traumatic having to transfer in the middle of the ocean from a big boat to a small boat. And then that small boat, we would be boated into the island. And from there on, it would be about a 30-minute walk to my grandmother's home.
Wow. Wow, Chef. That is something else. But, through that trauma, I guess, or, multiple trips there, it seems that you have incorporated this richness of sort of an understanding of organic ingredients. And I don't mean that in the today's sense of the word, how food works. And
definition of Korean food for me was my meals at that island. Korean food has always been medicinal. It was always more about health. Korean restaurants, we don't have a history because of so many wars and so many battles. Places like France, European countries, even in Japan, there's hundreds of years of restaurant history where many chefs have sort of carried the national cuisine through books and restaurants. Korea didn't have that. Korea, yeah. it was always about the mom cooking for their family. So you know, to make your family healthy, they had to first choose the best ingredients. And to make them eat these ingredients, they had to make it delicious. It wasn't sort of like at a restaurant where you make it delicious to get more customers to come.
Yeah.
No, that was not it.
Yeah.
Korea has been suffering from malnutrition until the 60s because it was so war-ridden. And, you know, getting healthy ingredients was a battle in its own right. But to make it taste good so your kids would eat as much as possible to be healthy was the mom's job. And that's where I think that really is what Korean food is to me as a cuisine.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for explaining. We need to cut to a quick little commercial break, but after the break, I want to talk about how your experience in French fine dining training has influenced some of your cooking. So we'll be right back chatting more with Hoonhee Kim.
During this time, it's more important than ever to support our friends and neighbors in the restaurant industry. Restaurant Workers Community Foundation has set up a national COVID-19 crisis relief fund. The money they raise will provide direct relief to individual restaurant workers, support other nonprofits serving restaurant workers in crisis, and offer zero interest loans for restaurants to get back up and running. Visit restaurantworkerscf.org to donate today. And if you need a little extra motivation, you can DM your $20 donation to RWCF's co-founder, John DeBerry, on Twitter, and he'll give you directions for making a signature quarantine cocktail. Donate now at restaurantworkerscf.org.
Okay, and we're back. You're listening to Eat Your Words, and today's guest is Chef Hoonhee Kim, whose latest book is called, his first book, that is, but it just came out, and it's called My Korea. Wow. So, Chef, thank you so much for explaining sort of the roots, the purpose of real traditional Korean cooking. I noticed throughout this book that, also in your experience, you've cooked at Masa, but you've also cooked at Danielle. So that is Danielle Belude's sort of namesake restaurant. And I love the look of one dish. It looks very perfect for like a rainy day like today. It is your braised short ribs, which you say it's a sort of a nod to your French training at Danielle. Tell me about that. Yeah.
So as I mentioned before, braising is a popular technique in Korea, but Korea still, most houses don't have ovens. An oven in, you know, European or even the US, every kitchen has one, or every stove comes with an oven, but not in Korea. Korea, it's all about sort of just cooking on
the stove,
or traditionally direct fire. So when we say braise in Korean, we're not talking specific temperatures and timing, which in French cuisine, that's sort of how you braise. And I learned working at Danielle, the perfect braise for a short rib was at 325 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 hours and 20 minutes. And, you know, stuff like that, those techniques I did transfer to my book, because this book is published here, and here most people have ovens. But mm-hmm. even the Korean cookbooks that are famous in Korea, they don't have directions of how to braise in an oven. They don't give times. They don't give specific temperatures. And Korean cookbooks are famous for not giving measurements of salt, soy sauce, or other fermented ingredients, because they understand they're all different.
Yeah.
So, you know, and even here, a teaspoon of kosher salt and a teaspoon of Himalayan salt, huge difference, more than double the salinity in the Himalayan salts.
Right.
But, you know, at least here, most people are familiar with kosher salt and Himalayan salt, and to sort of distinguish. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just in Korea, people don't have ovens. It was that, and also learning how to cook at Danielle. It was important for me to sort of know the foundation, which was the mother sauces, the basic techniques of sauteing, braising. And that I applied to me as a chef, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to know how to cook the classic Korean dishes, the traditional Korean recipes. And at first, I did not know how to do that. I never worked at a Korean restaurant. Okay. There were no Korean chefs when I was learning how to cook. And this was, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So that's why I learned, you know, I worked at Danielle. That's why I worked at Masa, because I wanted to work at a Korean restaurant under a Korean chef. But at that time, there weren't any.
Wow.
So, you know, these recipes I sort of figured out on my own, based on tasting a lot of Korean cuisine back in Korea. And even now, I'm in the process of learning traditional Korean food.
Right.
And that's why I go back 4-5 times a year.
Right.
I was lucky enough to meet somebody who I really respect, and who has taught me the past 10 years so much about Korean cuisine that I was able to, or confident enough to write a book like this, because I feel like I know more about Korean food than anybody in this country, at least.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That makes me wonder, Chef, do you think that today's young, let's say young upstart, or not even, like some young folks just thinking about maybe becoming a chef, is it even helpful for them to go and train under like the French classic, you know, masters or whatever? And could they just sidestep and connect with a Korean chef like you didn't have at that time?
So, you know, for me, what I learned at Danielle, at that time, where it was before Per Se, it was before John George, it was before, all these other, French restaurants, that were, there. It was 140 seat fine dining restaurant. And we did about 300 to 350 covers on a busy day. And what I learned was there's nothing impossible in a Danielle kitchen. Every restaurant I worked after that was so much easier. So to have that confidence, knowing whatever is thrown at me, I can do, because I did it for 2 years at Danielle. That I could never sort of have experienced without working for Danielle. And I still thank the chefs over there. And you know, being a chef, you know, it is about cooking. It is about techniques. It is about sort of finding your flavors from within to showcase at your own restaurant later on. But a lot of it is mental. So much of it is mental, where if you don't have that confidence, and if you're nervous every day because maybe your sous chef won't show up, or maybe your line cooks won't show up, or maybe two of them won't show up, or maybe the dishwasher won't show up. Every day something's going to happen. And you have to know that you can put out same caliber food mm-hmm. with half your staff when it comes down to it, because you've done it before. You know, I feel like working for the great chefs, you will get experiences like that. You will gain experiences like that. And because of that, I do recommend every cook to get into one of these big, famous chefs' restaurants to experience, mm-hmm. to gain that confidence. Because, you know, it's a privilege to be so busy.
Yeah.
And so pushed.
Yeah.
And to gain that confidence. It is a privilege, and not many restaurants you're able to do that.
I see. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that could happen for somebody who's training at Danji? You're a Michelin starred restaurant.
Yes, Danji, we have 4 cooks cooking on the line. Mm-hmm. We only have 36 seats, but we've done 200 covers for dinner.
Okay.
We do over six seatings. Because it's in a neighborhood where we have pre-theater and post-theater. Most restaurants are busy from 7 p.m. to 9:30, 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. But because of the theater, we're busy at 5 p.m. because people want to come in and eat before their 7 o'clock show. And then some of the big theaters, their show starts at 8. So by the time we get them out at 6:30 for the first showing, we get the people coming in want to eat before the 8 o'clock shows. So we do 2 seatings before 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
We do get busy, but
yeah,
most New York City restaurants, to be busy.
I wonder if there's like the inverse of this. Could like the bedrock of fine dining for some be a Korean restaurant? And then maybe they go off to start, I don't know, a French restaurant. It speaks to their heritage.
You know, I think the fine dining restaurants, at least in New York, the ingredients are very similar to that of a fine dining French restaurant or a fine dining Japanese restaurant. Because ultimately, fine dining or any successful restaurant is about procuring the best ingredients.
Okay.
And local ingredients tend to be best, especially when it comes to produce.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the transportation of getting fish from Asia, getting certain spices from Africa, that's pretty easy these days.
I see.
So the ingredients that you find at a Danielle or at a Cheongshik, which is a fine dining French restaurant versus a fine dining Korean restaurant, the ingredients tend to be very similar.
I see.
These fine dining restaurants are all using truffles, all using caviar, all using Japanese fish. And I think one of the best ways to learn how to cook is, it's not about recipes. It's about knowing your ingredients.
Yeah.
And if you know your ingredients, you can later on create dishes. Where if you learn how to cook based on recipes, without that recipe, you're lost. Yeah, just get yourself into a very good restaurant under a chef who's there a lot.
And I
think that's the best first step.
I think that brings us back to maybe the cover of this book, right? So we're thinking of, you know, this cabbage and how, you know, making kimchi is going to be a little different each time, right?
Yes. And even in Korea, culturally, you know, kimchi was too difficult to make. Well, not too difficult, but it wasn't worth it for each family to make.
Okay.
There's a term, Korean word called kimjang, basically means like the whole village or a bunch of families get together in late fall when cabbage is the best tasting. And they make thousands of heads of cabbage into kimchi for the entire year for the whole village. Or all the families. And I've made, last year I made 4,000 heads of cabbage into kimchi in Korea. Traditionally that's how it was done. But nowadays, you know, people living in apartments in Seoul, they just buy kimchi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the biggest complaint is it doesn't taste the same. There's preservatives in there. And it's not healthy. When a company or a factory makes kimchi, they have to put preservatives in or some certain chemicals in.
Really?
So, yeah, because if you let this kimchi keep fermenting, the air is going to expand and pop the bags. It's going to start leaking out of jars. It's not going to be pretty. And you know how kimchi smells like. Not pretty. So there is a lot of chemicals added.
Okay.
And whenever you add chemicals to fermentation, it doesn't ferment properly. Fermentation as a technique, you should avoid as much outside contamination, man-made chemical contamination. And that's why in the book, I really recommend using Himalayan salt or salt, not sea salt that's been contaminated by our dirty waters, and using, you know, cabbage that is organic, not contaminated with pesticides, because all of these chemicals really, it messes with not just the flavors, but the one of the reasons why fermentation is a big deal these days is because of the probiotics.
Okay.
You know, how the probiotics in the fermented foods gets into our gut biome, and our gut biome now is responsible not just for our physical health, but it's coming out that for mental health as well. And especially these days, immunity is so important, and a healthy gut biome really increases your immunity.
Right.
So, you know, if you use these sort of chemicals in the fermentation, you lose a lot of the probiotics.
Got it. You know, I think you just convinced me to make my own batch of kimchi right now.
It's one of those things that, you know, it's difficult the first couple of times around, but once you get the hang of it, you're just going to make it by yourself, because it's not difficult. It's just new. This whole technique and waiting for 2 weeks after you make it to eat it. It's a new philosophy. It's a new culture of cooking, the waiting for this fermentation. But once you do it, you can control your food. You'll know right away. You know, nobody, you know, in Western culture recommends you eating spicy food for breakfast, right? But you make your own kimchi and you eat it for breakfast, your stomach will be so settled the entire day. You'll be less hungry. You'll have less irritation, less gas. And that's the power of fermentation. Yeah. It's the power of probiotics.
Oh, man, I'm going for it. I'm going for it. And thank you so much for, you know, not editing out, you know, all the authentic details in here. I love it.
I do give, you know, a little bit of shortcuts that, you know, it might make it a little easier because we live in apartments.
Sure. Yeah.
But ultimately, none of the really important techniques have been watered down. I make things easier, but I don't make things lesser, if that makes sense.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many more ingredients. I mean, so many more recipes and dishes throughout this book that I would love to talk to you about. But it looks like we're just about out of time for today.
Okay.
But actually, I might as well mention that we are going to be having another discussion in a couple months. So at June 7th for the Museum of Food and Drink, we will have a discussion with Hoonee Kim. So mark your calendars. That'll be 7 p.m. Eastern time, a virtual talk, Museum of Food and Drink, MOFAD.com. So, check it out. I'll keep you guys posted. You can follow Hoonee Kim on his Instagram. And it's just Hoonee Kim, right?
Yes.
And also the restaurants you can find from there. So I hope everyone gets their hands on My Korea. And thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me, Kathy.
Yeah, and more to come, I hope, too. It's really, really a remarkable book with a lot more that we didn't even touch on. So, so thanks, everyone, at Heritage Radio Network. Thank you, G, our Heritage Engineer Extraordinaire. And we'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.